Soccer Talk Podcast, the only podcast that focuses on watching soccer on TV, online and apps. In episode 127, we discuss the trials and tribulations of TNT's Champions League experiment, an interview with Caitlin Murray about her new US Women's National Team book, how well the Champions League final did in the TV ratings, a look ahead at the Women's World Cup and the TV coverage there, plus letters from you, the listeners, in our mailbag section. My name is Christopher Harris, a.k.a. The Gaffer, and I'm joined by my co-host, as always, Kartik Krishnayar. Now, Kartik, it's been a whirlwind week this past week. I mean, we've had, obviously, since this last recording, we've had the UEFA Champions League final, of course, and then the US friendly against Jamaica, so on and so forth, and actually a whole bunch of other games too, of course. But let's start off with that USA against Jamaica game that was on Wednesday night on FS1, and this one with John Strong and Stuart Holden commentating on this one. One of the things I found, Kartik, just watching this game, is that when the US men's national team are not doing well, there's not much to talk about. John Strong gets extremely quiet during the broadcast, almost like to a level where he seems to be, I don't know, depressed or just so down on this team that there's just long gaps of silence, which is unlike him, because usually he's very talkative. He's even non-stop going through the game, talk, same with Stuart Holden. But this one was a little bit different. What are your thoughts?
Yeah, I changed the channel to Univision after about 20 minutes, or maybe even sooner than that, because the U.S. played decently for the first 10 minutes, was bad after that, really bad. And my annoyance level was about the number of stats, which I think were meaningless, that were being thrown out, and the sort of a platitudes Holden as the co-commentator were giving. They were obvious, easy bits of analysis that even armchair, a lot of the analysis about the U.S. men's national team from the U.S. men's national team fan base is bad, generally, and has been for years. People who know me have heard me criticize it, have even seen me say that I won't tweet during U.S. games because U.S. fans are not getting the full picture. But this match was relatively easy to kind of understand why the U.S. was having problems in their team, and it seems like there was that analysis was missing, that bit of analysis. I like John Strong as a commentator. I do think, like many American commentators, he's very stat heavy, but I think you are onto something, Chris, because his commentary style, when he does international matches like at the World Cup last summer, not involving the United States, and when he does an MLS match where he's ostensibly a neutral. I mean, we know he has ties to Portland, but throwing that out, where he's ostensibly a neutral, when he's done Champions League matches in the past, many of them, he's ostensibly a neutral. There's something very different about the way he calls U.S. men's national team games. And I don't know if that's necessarily just him. I mean, if you think about even the Ian Darks of the world, who've called a lot of U.S. men's national team games in the last decade, There might be, and JP Del Camera, there might be a difference. Actually, I'm not sure with Del Camera if there's a difference, but with Dark, there might be a slight difference, but not quite like Strong. I think that some of the finer points of what make him such a good commentator tend to go away during men's national team games, particularly when you see the sort of performance you did last night, which, it's one of these things where Americans, and I've complained about this, Chris, and we I think we did a whole show on this after the U.S. was eliminated from the World Cup qualifying in 2017, for the 2018 World Cup, where American commentators don't necessarily talk tactics and talk about obvious tactical flaws in a way that they should. Now, I'm not I think last night it was pretty obvious what was going wrong. You can blame Greg Berhalter, but at the same time, I've seen Berhalter's teams with Columbus. They're able to execute the style of play he wants executed without this sort of awful-looking performance. I think maybe a lot of it has to do with just the talent level of the United States and the fact that Berhalter relied on a lot of foreign players in Columbus. But it was weird. So I switched to Univision, and that broadcast was pretty good and very objective. And I also think I don't know if this is again the way the signal's transmitted. I noticed the pictures on Univision coming from Audi Field were a little crisper than they had been on FS1. That's another concern about Fox.
That would be one of the weaknesses, though. I mean, so John Strong definitely I think is one of the best, if not the best, commentator in the United States, an American commentator. Except when it comes to U.S. men's national team games, except when it comes to Major League Soccer games, because it's difficult, though. So most commentators will try to play it right down the middle, will try to make sure that they don't seem too biased. I mean, they seem that they're very objective. And it's usually the role of the co-commentator to come in with those expert opinions and observations. And they're the ones that are more kind of making some really cutting remarks in regards to what they've seen in front of their eyes, opening up our view in terms of some of the things that maybe we don't see or we don't think about, just elevating the game. So John Strong's in a difficult role because, you know what I mean, you can tell that it's weighing on him in terms of how bad the U.S. is performing. But really, to me, it's more Stu Holden that should be coming in. And he didn't have that many punches. You could tell that Stu was disappointed with the performance. And towards the end of the game, I think it was just saying, like, there's really not much to say about this. There was very little chances created, very little anything of interest that you can say that the U.S. did well in this area or this attack was good or whatever it may be. But I think in this particular case, if you did have an Ian Dark and a Taylor Twellman, it would have been a completely different broadcast. Now, Ian Dark's one of the very, very few commentators that does sway into the criticism, does get into that a little bit more, but in more of a conversational manner. So, you mean during a slow ebb of the game, if it was on ESPN, you can imagine hearing Ian Dark talking about, this is really a very disappointing performance. You mean Taylor, what do you think? Like, what can they do better? And Twellman's the guy who would come in really, really hard and say, okay, this is, you know, atrocious. This is horrible. We're so far off the path, that, you know, so on and so forth, whatever he would say. And that's lacking on the Fox side. Now, my concern in this game, watching this game, which it's a meaningless friendly, it's a ramp up, it's, you mean, trying a different formation. So I wasn't so concerned about the actual scoreline itself. But to me, the two biggest issues I had was, one, this does not get me any more excited about the Gold Cup than I was before, which before I wasn't excited. This makes me even less excited about the Gold Cup. But second of all, I think this hurts the U.S. women's national team, because right after this game between USA and Jamaica, they had, a preview show about the Women's World Cup and about the U.S. women's national team. And I think probably many of the listeners, like me, after that USA-Jamaica game, switched off the TV. It was like, okay, forget that. I mean, I'm going to watch something else or call it a night. But having the U.S. men's national team joined at the hip in many ways with the U.S. women's team actually makes the U.S. women's team, it just doesn't get me excited about the U.S. women's team because of how poor the men are doing. Having said that, though, too, the men are doing so poorly that, you know, I think all of us are hoping that the U.S. women's national team can actually raise the bar, get us excited again about U.S. soccer, about the national team. And if it's on the women's side, I mean, more power to them. That'll be fantastic. But to me, I walked away from this broadcast thinking that, feeling very dejected, feeling very down on the Gold Cup, and also having no interest in watching the U.S. women's national team broadcast that happened right after this game. And I'm sure if the U.S. had put in a good performance against Jamaica, maybe shown some positivity, that probably more viewers would have tuned in or continued watching the U.S. women's national team preview that they did for the Women's World Cup.
See, it's really hard to tell, Chris. I think it could go one of two ways. I mean, I there are a lot of people who I talk to big U.S. fans, men who are just like, oh, at least we have the women. I can't wait for the World Cup this summer, because they don't want to to think about this men's program. Although we were saying this a couple of days after the U.S. pulled a shock result of the U-20 World Cup. Yeah, that's not the senior team, but that victory over France, which I'm sure we'll get to in a few minutes, does inject some hope into the U.S. men's program. But there are just a lot of people who've said that to me. Oh my gosh, I've never been so excited for the Women's World Cup, even though this, at least in theory, and we're going to talk to Caitlin Murray in a little bit, this is a more competitive World Cup. And the U.S. Did not win some less competitive World Cups in the 2000s, right? 2003 and 2007, got to the final in 11 and got beat by Japan in a dramatic game. But this is a more competitive World Cup than any World Cup we've had at the women's level. Yet so many U.S. fans I talked to, Chris, are excited. And part of that excitement has to do with the men's team. Now, where I do think there is a definite drag is on the Gold Cup. I quite frankly think the combination of the U.S.'s just the malaise around the U.S. men's program, the continued lingering effects of the selection of Greg Berhalter, who might be the right guy. I mean, I've said some favorable things about him, but I think everybody believes the process to get to him was flawed and that it was what you would call an inside job. And now with the backdrop of Tab Ramos, who a lot of people had wanted for the job but wasn't even interviewed, getting the U-20s again, third successive quarterfinal at the U-20 level. U.S. is the only country in the world to do that, by the way. There are more questions being asked. Where I think it's going to make a difference is for Fox and Telemundo's Gold Cup. Fox and Univision's Gold Cup. I think it's a definite drag on that tournament because at the same time you have the Women's World Cup going on, which everyone's going to be focused on, Fox and Telemundo. And then you've got Copa America going on, which casual soccer fans who might be cheering on the U.S. women during the day, they don't really want to watch more of this nonsense from the U.S. men or what they perceive as nonsense, and they're going to turn on the stars of South America on Telemundo and on ESPN+. So it's a little bit of a trade-off for Fox because they've got both the Women's World Cup and the Gold Cup. I think there's more enthusiasm about the Women's World Cup because of the failings of the U.S. men's team, but it is going to hurt their Gold Cup ratings, that is my thinking.
Yeah, that was the thing at halftime too of the U.S. Jamaica game too. There was a promo, an ad for upcoming USA Gold Cup game against Guyana, and nothing against no offense against Guyana, but it's hard for me to get excited about even the opponents too. So yeah, it's not going to be until probably the quarterfinal stage or the semifinal stage where that tournament becomes really more important and more a must-see event. The earlier rounds of those games are going to be, what's the benefit of watching those games? And unless you're a hardcore U.S. men's national team supporter. One more thing, too, about this coverage, too, Kartik, is that actually leading into the Women's World Cup is I'm excited about this tournament. I'm really excited about watching, from Friday onwards, the games, opening ceremony, etc. The feeling I'm getting, though, Kartik, is that just in talking to just casual sports fans, soccer moms, etc., is that most people aren't excited about the Women's World Cup until Tuesday, when the U.S. women's national team begins. And to many people, I believe that's really when the U.S. when the Women's World Cup will begin, is on Tuesday. So FIFA, in terms of the draw and the schedule, it actually hurts the Women's World Cup in that, you got Friday, Saturday, Sunday, Monday. You got like four days of games where the U.S. women are not involved. And then on the Tuesday they are. So that's going to take away, I think, from the if the U.S. was playing on a Saturday opening game, I think that would bring the viewers in a lot faster. So I'm sure that's something in the back of the minds of Fox and Telemundo, what they're thinking in terms of, man, if only the U.S. women were actually playing sooner in this tournament to pull people in. Now, Kartik, in terms of other games from this past weekend, you mentioned the U.S. Under-20 team and the victory against France. What was your take on this one in terms of the coverage and the match itself?
Yeah, the Fox Sports app at first, it gave me all kinds of trouble to log in. And I was quite panicky at the office because and this was a weird thing because I think a lot of people were logging in on their phones. I was logging in on my iPad. They were not having the trouble I was having. In fact, someone logged into Fox Sports Go on their computer. at the office to watch the game, no problem. So I was thinking, maybe I'll just have to watch the game with him. But I ended up getting it up on my iPad so I could stay at my desk. It was Keith Costigan and Mo Adu have developed the chemistry during this tournament, and I think we've talked about it in relative to Turner's coverage of the Champions League, how Mo Adu has improved as a studio presence through that through the season. He's also improved as a co-commentator. Keith Costigan, I think, is the best guy Fox has. It's funny. We're just talking about John Strong's Portland connections. Keith Costigan's got Portland connections also. We're going to talk to Caitlin Murray later in the show, who's, of course, from Portland. But Costigan and Adu were really good during this match, and it was a back and forth dramatic match. There were a lot of things that Mo Adu pointed out tactically in this match that you don't necessarily get pointed out during your coverage of U.S. men's national team matches on Fox. Now, again, those were friendlies. We're going into a Gold Cup. The U.S. hasn't had a competitive match. I haven't watched a competitive U.S. match on Fox in over 2 years because I switched to Univision during the qualifying because of the propaganda value I thought of the Fox coverage and was unfortunately proven correct when the U.S. didn't qualify for the World Cup, right? And the diluted analysis on Fox had proven to be completely misguided. But I thought Adu was really good in talking about how the U.S. had to work to negate France's advantages, and also how in the large portions of the game where France was on top, why they were on top, and Costigan is very good. This provides a bit of a dilemma for Fox now. They are all in on Women's World Cup coverage. They've got a number of matches on, obviously, on Saturday on Big Fox. Yet the U.S. is playing in the quarterfinals, and that will either be on FS1 or FS2. I think it's on FS1 against Ecuador, but it will be running concurrent, more or less, with one of those Women's World Cup games, which is on Big Fox. It's a good dilemma to have, I think, for Fox, but I don't think anyone was quite expecting this U.S. run. I know there had been a lot of hype about this U.S. U-20 team before the World Cup, U-20 World Cup. I didn't really buy into it because I just don't with the U.S. anymore. I watched the first game against Ukraine, who I think is one of the favorites to win the tournament. The U.S. loses, Chris, but I walk away, and I think we may have talked about this on this podcast last week. That match was on Yeah, we did talk about it on this podcast last week. I walk away from that match thinking, yeah, you know, the U.S. played well against who I consider one of the favorites, one of the top European youth teams, one of the favorites in the tournament. They're probably going to be pretty good if they get a good draw, and sure enough, they haven't lost since then. They haven't drawn since then. So far, so good.
So a few things there. So the USA against Ecuador quarterfinal U20 World Cup, it'll be on FS2 on Saturday, I think at 11:30 a.m. Eastern time. So that's one of the advantages, I guess, of Fox on the weekends, especially for the Women's World Cup, having a lot of the games on Big Fox, over-the-air Fox, and FS1, is that they do have the opportunity to put some of those games on FS2. Now, this France against USA game, I have to admit, Kartik, this is embarrassing in a way. But so for the last 2 years, I've been a cord cutter. Still am. I mean, definitely 100% cord cutting. But my community where I live just did a deal with Comcast where they offer each of the residents free cable. So against my wishes, my wife said, okay, let's go ahead and sign up for this free cable. I mean, what the heck? It's free. Let's get it installed. So we got it installed. So for the France against the USA game, I thought, okay, let me just sit down on the couch and then we watch this game. And switched on Comcast, switched on FS2. Started watching the game, and I'm like, this looks horrible. It's in SD. It's not HD. The last 2 years, I've been just, I guess, in many ways, spoiled by watching a lot of the Fox coverage, especially on FS2 or whether it's beIN Sports or whatever channel it is, in HD through Fubo. And it's been so long that I've actually watched a FS2 game in SD that I was like, man, this looks absolutely horrible. But the game itself, yeah, great win by the United States, and Mo Adu is getting better with each match. That's good to see, and I think he's come a long way. I think the actual UEFA Champions League coverage and analysis has helped him, helped his confidence, and then teaming up with Keith Costigan, who's a consummate professional. Both of them did a good job in that regard.
Chris, that's just a great point about FS2 that we often forget. We see the numbers now up to about 66 million or so households, but so many of those are still in SD, whereas when you look at the number for FS1, NBC, SN, ESPN, TNT, whatever channel shows soccer other than FS2, they're generally all in HD. So that's a great point. I hadn't thought about that, but I know a couple other people who have Comcast who have FS2 in HD and are forced to feel like they're probably better off logging in online and watching games or just skipping them.
Now we have to turn to the UEFA Champions League final, which was shown live on TNT as well as Univision and Univision Deportes. And Kartik, throughout this entire season, we've probably covered TNT's coverage of the Champions League as well as Univision more than any other broadcast outlet there, both in spoken word and in written word. We've interviewed their executives. We've interviewed, I think, Stu Holden. We've had FAQs. We've had tons of information out there and analysis about their coverage. And overall, over the course of the season, up until the Champions League final, not including the Champions League final, it had been a rocky road. Starting off strong in terms of just a kind of a breath of fresh air presentation in terms of the way that they covered the Champions League in I think, the group stage, actually before the qualification stage back in August, I believe. Then some really bad mistakes, just some really awkward transitions between the two studios. On this podcast, I mean, also the listeners too, inputting their feedback, but a lot of it, us giving our recommendations, our analysis, and over the course of the season, it had improved. And then, I mean, usually a couple of weeks later, then they would make some other mistakes, or they'd have Stu Holden and Steve Nash commentating a game from Barcelona, doing the commentary, which was absolutely horrible, so on and so forth. So building up to the Champions League final, I was optimistic because they had a lot of the issues that they had before that, they had corrected. They had reverted to a one studio format, which was much better in terms of communication, in terms of just the flow, rather than going back from Atlanta to Los Angeles and back and forth. So again, going into the UEFA Champions League final, my hopes, I thought that they had it. I thought that, okay, here we go. This is going to be pretty simple. I mean, just don't do anything too crazy. Just keep it simple. Keep on doing what you're doing. And then all of a sudden, for the UEFA Champions League final, they threw all that stuff out the window and said, okay, let's mix things up. Let's change things completely. And what a disaster. What an absolute disaster this UEFA Champions League final was. And for all the hard work that they have done all season long, trying different things, learning, I think they just screwed it up completely on the final. And it leaves a bitter taste in a lot of soccer fans' mouths in terms of, that's the lasting impression of UEFA Champions League season, is that last final when they could have come out with a really strong effort. It was dismal. Kartik, specifically, were there certain things in that broadcast that you looked at and thought, okay, what the heck are they doing?
Yeah, so I only got to see about 20 minutes of the TNT broadcast or listen to it because I had a Miami FC game and I wanted to be in position at 3 so I could watch the game. So left my house around 1:50 Eastern time. But that first 20 minutes, I sat through Trae Young. I sat through Steve Kerr. I sat through some other basketball thing. I didn't see any analysis whatsoever. And then as I'm driving south from Fort Lauderdale area, from Broward County to the Miami area, I'm getting all these text messages about how bad TNT is. This isn't an NBA pregame show. Obviously, you should be watching the game on Univision, blah, blah, blah. I did not know about the snafu with the BT broadcast versus the international feed until later that night, because again, I was not listening. I was then just watching the game without commentary. That seems a very unforgivable production snafu. So all in all, I guess pretty bad. And then watch the post game show when I later that night, Saturday night, after got home from the Miami FC match, and it was I think somewhat embarrassing. I mean, Fox Fox had at least a proper way of presenting a trophy ceremony and the aftermath of a match. Maybe that was honed. Maybe we should go back to 2010 and think about Bayern Inter and how Fox handled the aftermath of that. But compare directly. But 10 years on or 9 years on, it was shocking. So Turner not getting a lot right. I look at the coverage of the UEFA Nations League from ESPN, where Taylor Twellman and Ian Dark, obviously Ian Dark's based in London, so it's easy enough to get him to Porto. But Taylor Twellman has gone to Porto for the matches. He was fantastic yesterday, by the way. I mentioned that. His analysis was Twellman is top shelf. Sometimes I wonder if he didn't have an American accent, if he had another accent, if people would put him in the absolute elite category of co-commentators, because when he's on, he's on. And he was seeing that match in a way I think very few co-commentators would. But I compare that and ESPN's commitment to an event that hasn't necessarily caught on yet, in the Nations League, and their willingness to send their top broadcast team there. They'll do England – we're taping this on Thursday. They'll do England-Netherlands in person. They're going to do the final in person to Turner's. Commitment of just flipping feeds on at the last minute, I guess, sending the studio team, and I guess that was good that the four of them were in Madrid. I think as a UEFA rights holder, you get that broadcast position as part of your contract at the final. So I think they basically had it. It's in the contract, right? I think every broadcaster from around the world gets some sort of position in the stadium. That's in their contract. So they had to send someone, but it was just shambolic. Now, look, we saw Fox's coverage improve a lot from year one of the Champions League through like year three or four. We've seen lots of improvements in ESPN's MLS coverage through the years. We've seen NBC started hot with the Premier League and they've stayed hot. There are opportunities to improve. We've even seen like BN go from being somewhat clunky in year one when they launched the network here in the U.S. with La Liga and Serie A and Liga to being at the top of their game within 3 or 4 years. So there is hope for Turner. Chris, it's just there seems to be at times this season. This is why I think I'm really frustrated and you are too. I don't want to put words in your mouth, but I think I sense the same thing, that there have been glimmers throughout the course of this Champions League campaign where we think, they finally got it. That was a crisp pregame show. That was a crisp studio show. That was a great match day. And then they'll come back for the next match day 2 weeks later and it'll be back to this kind of chaotic, rather worthless coverage. So I don't know. They have a summer to reboot and rethink it.
Well, the challenge that they have now is that most soccer fans, if you ask most soccer fans in the United States about TNT's coverage, it's negative. You mean so for them to regain that faith and trust and to change that behavior or to change that thinking, it could take a whole other season. Even if they're doing it at the top of their game, it could take a long time to change that first impression. From this coverage of the UEFA Champions League final, it almost felt like they said at the last minute, okay, let's take our normal producer of the Champions League and let's have him do something else. We're going to bring somebody new in to do this completely different. It almost felt like that, or that the producer that they're using had a lot of pressure on him, and they said, okay, guys, you got to change things around. You got to focus more on basketball. You're going to do this and this, and changed his thinking because what we saw was absolutely horrible. Some specifics. I mean, the pre-match coverage, it really should have been renamed from BR Football to BR Basketball. I'm not a basketball fan. I'm a soccer fan. So when I'm coming into this coverage to watch UEFA Champions League final, I'm expecting analysis from soccer people, people that know the game inside and out. I'm not anticipating all these tie-ins to basketball. I think basketball, NBA, by itself, even without soccer, is fine. I mean, it's thriving. TNT doesn't need to go ahead and kind of, basically cherry pick things out of the UEFA Champions League to try to pull over soccer fans into the basketball to improve ratings there. That was really, really poorly done. The change of commentators, starting with BT in the first half with Darren Fletcher. And I didn't catch who the co-commentator was at first. I'm like, who is that? That sounds familiar. And after a while, I figured out it was Steve McManaman. And Macca paired with Darren Fletcher was nowhere near Macca paired with Ian Dark. The chemistry wasn't quite there. It didn't sound like Macca. It sounded like Macca, the voice, but did not sound like him, the usual, what we're used to hearing on American television when he did work for ESPN broadcasting the Premier League. But throughout that first half, and then I'm sure the reason that they changed it, but throughout that first half, Darren Fletcher kept on giving promos for BT. Well, coming up after this game, we got a movie coming happening, or and then a few minutes later, BT's coverage of whatever it would be, politics tomorrow, come back at 12 o'clock for this. So I completely understand why TNT said, okay, all right, second half, let's switch it to the world feed. Let's have Tony Jones and David Pleat, and there we can get some commentary that's not going to be giving plugs for BT Sport. My question is, why go with BT Sport in the beginning if you know that, usually Fox had done that in the past before, but they would mute it whenever the actual commentators would be talking about Sky Sports coming up this weekend or whatever it would be. They would mute it, so we would never actually hear that on American television. In this case, they didn't mute any of it. Then there was the halftime analysis where all season long, Stuart Holden has been doing tremendous work on the big, huge TV screens or on the table with his tactical analysis and oftentimes lately with Mo Adu in terms of, okay, let's look at the formation, let's look at the matchups, who's going to be moving here, how's this changed the game. And for the halftime for that analysis, they used a whiteboard. And it looked like it looked so hokey, it looked so cheap, it looked so amateur on a UEFA Champions League broadcast at halftime. If you don't have access to a big screen TV or it's not going to work, don't go to a whiteboard. No matter how great the analysis is, it makes Stu Holden and TNT look amateur. Last but not least, actually two more things. One is, I don't know what Stu Holden was thinking, but wearing a green jacket was so distracting. It looked like he should have been at the Masters golf tournament, but it was comical. It's like, obviously there's somebody, the producer should be saying like, hey, let's kind of tone that down a little bit. Let's kind of wear something a little bit more neutral. We don't need you to be wearing a green jacket, being the center of focus, when the center of focus really should be the presenter, and the presenter goes over and talks to the actual analyst. And then David Pleat, we've talked about in the past before. A lot of people love him. A lot of people hate him. I'm okay with him. I'm not a fan of his by any means, but I appreciate what he's given to the game. But typical David Pleat, Origi scores the late goal, and there he goes, David Pleat calling him Arrigo. And I'm like, come on, this is absolutely abysmal. I mean, the BT thing didn't work out. The world feeds having David Pleat for the semi-final, I believe it was, and for the final, is some poor decision making there by probably IMG, I would believe it would be, but overall really, really poor stuff. I'll read a comment from one of the listeners, Greg. You'll never walk alone. Half hour into the pre-match show and we have seen a 5-minute cartoon and a silly Trae Young feature. Lineups have been in for both teams and not shown or discussed. They did say Kane starts. And then Kate Abdo says, we will talk about lineups later in the show. Terrible. And that should be the most important information. That should be as soon as those actual lineups are announced. That's almost breaking news. Okay, all right, let's interrupt this for a second. Okay, lineups are in. And in some ways, in many ways, the Liverpool lineup was very predictable. The Spurs one, the question about whether Kane starts or not, I guess Kate mentioned it, but that's important news. That's showing the priority to these teams and to this occasion rather than just talking on and on about nonsense. But overall, if I had to rate it, I'd probably give it a D-. I was just really, really disappointed with TNT, and I thought they could have done much, much better. And it's going to take a long time and a long amount of effort to change people's opinions now about TNT. They really screwed it up.
Yeah, a couple quick points, Chris, on this. One, I think there are a lot of fans who think that, and I know the motivation for pushing Bleacher Report and the BR Live product and Bleacher Report in general, but feel like the Turner executives, and there might be some serious changes at Turner, by the way, in terms of Turner Sports because of the AT&T purchase of Time Warner and new executives, et cetera. So maybe things will change. But that there's a demeaning quality to kind of relegating it to BR and BR Live when they don't they don't do that with their NBA coverage. They don't do that with their NCAA tournament coverage. Yes, they plug those things, but they don't necessarily push it as a BR Live thing. Secondly, I think the NBA thing is all about an insecurity among American broadcasters that have to kind of show some sort of relevance of soccer, relevance of international football to an Americanized audience. So they feel like Fox did this with the NFL. And I have to say the synergies between the NBA and NBA and soccer and the and basketball fans and soccer fans are greater than between American football. I mean, most soccer fans I know in the U.S. can't stand American football. Casual sports fans or soccer fans watch American football, but there is more crossover with basketball. So, and there are more just a lot. I don't want to get into a whole ideological debate, but there's more crossover in the fan bases. So Turner decides this is a way of proving some degree of cred, and it's easier with basketball because there probably are more basketball players who are soccer fans, like the Trae Youngs and like former players like Steve Kerr. They're more. It's a more international sport. It's a more the demographics of the type of people who watch the sport are different than American football. Fox tried for years with American football. You know that, Chris, to just push, you know, give soccer some sort of credit by saying, oh, Michael Strahan is doing this and the pregame show, et cetera. So I understand that. I just think we're way past that. And then
Just on that, just real fast, Kartik. I mean, that broadcast of the UEFA Champions League final was not meant for us. It was not meant for soccer fans. It was meant to be appealing to a whole brand new audience, somebody that's probably maybe watched one Champions League game all season or just tuned into that, watching it, hearing, like, what's this whole thing about, and appealing to that audience. Now, whether that audience was blown away by how wonderful the coverage was with all these basketball players talking about how they're soccer fans, I don't think that tactic works. I think it's demeaning. I don't think it. I mean, maybe it does work. I don't think it does. But to me, you piss off the soccer fans. You talk down to the basketball fans, and I don't think there's many people that are going to say, "Okay, I watched this final. Now I'm going to watch more soccer now because of the connections to NBA basketball."
Yeah, it has a better chance of working with the NBA than it did with the NFL when Fox tried it, because there's just more crossover in fans and more similarities. But I don't think it works. Right, I agree with you. It's just it's a flawed strategy. The third thing I would say is about the BT snafu. Fox, on a number of occasions, and again, I probably watch more Bundesliga than most of our listeners, on a number of occasions has taken the BT feed for the Bundesliga. And what they've done is they haven't been able to mute out Owen Hargreaves saying, hey, you know, this match is on BT or this event is on BT Sport coming up. But what they have done is the promos, the graphical promos for BT have never appeared on Fox. And my understanding is they did on TNT.
I didn't see them.
Okay.
Yeah, it was just the commentary, I believe.
Yeah. Now, it was obviously a random Bundesliga match taking place on a Friday or a Saturday. It's a lot less intrusive and a lot less aggressive, the BT promotions, than during a Champions League final, which for BT Sport is one of their showcase events of the year. And they're going to be pushing their other programming. That's why it was such a flawed decision. On the David Pleat thing, yeah, I find that odd. That he got both the semifinal and the final, in the Europa League final as well.
That's the one I was thinking of. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. So that's to me quite interesting, because we haven't heard as much of his voice on Premier League broadcasts or FA Cup, League Cup broadcasts in the last few years.
It's puzzling, because it's almost as if, like, okay, who's available? Who's left? It's almost like, I mean, in terms of the list of co-commentators, I would put him near the bottom, definitely the bottom half of ones that I would consider hiring. So it's almost as if, like, whether it's IMG or the, kind of all these different broadcasters. Maybe Stuart Robson was working for somebody else. Maybe Gary.
Well, that specific issue. Okay, so I had this assumption during the week because Stuart Robson was on the ESPN FC set with Dan Thomas and co in Madrid on location, that Stuart Robson was going to be the co-commentator, and was very disappointed when I got back and listened to the DVR and it wasn't him in either half. So I don't know if he was committed to someone else. He was in Madrid for sure.
Yeah, and that's the thing about David Pleat. He reminds me of your anyone's elderly grandfather. I mean, it really seems to be a nice person, has a lot of history in the game, someone I have a lot of respect for as a manager, and with a lot of knowledge of the game, but forgets things. He means very forgetful and very talkative, very, very talkative, talking over the actual commentator. And for me, on a pedestal of the UEFA Champions League final and the Europa League final, he's near the bottom of the list of people I would pick. I just wonder how few people were available. I mean, other alternatives. There's so many people out there that they could have picked that would have been much, much better, a lot more consistent, and a lot more knowledgeable about players' names and so forth. But yeah, not a good look, unfortunately. And that's something that TNT should bring up with UEFA. I'm sure they'll have meetings over the summer getting ready for the next season, is that the quality of the world feeds. Usually it's been great all season long, except I mean, in two of the biggest finals of the competitions that they're paying, I mean, hundreds of millions of dollars for, you have a commentator that's not up to snuff. All right, co-commentator, I mean. All right, TV streaming news content. Let's move on to some interesting news from around the United States and the world.
Yeah, so there's been talk of reports of an NWSL TV deal that's in the works and will be announced soon. I've heard various rumors, but nothing has been announced. Maybe they take advantage of the surge in interest from the Women's World Cup and get back on television. They've been dark this year since the termination of their deal with Lifetime Dark in terms of linear television. NWSL is a league with a lot of issues. They have an operations issue that will have to be resolved. Operations contract will have to be resolved this year also. So we'll see what happens with that, but stay tuned.
Yeah, I guess with that one too, I mean, in terms of timing, I mean, everyone of course hoping that the U.S. women's national team does well and hopefully goes all the way, but that has such an impact on this TV deal, and I'm sure that they've had discussions with a lot of different TV providers and hoping that the timing of this deal will be perfect with the U.S. women's national team, and hopefully the success that they have, this could make a break the league in terms of the future longevity. Now, next up, the next two Club World Cup tournaments have been confirmed for Qatar in December 2019 and December 2020. The Club World Cup will have seven competing teams, six continental champions, and a team from the host nation. After Qatar hosts the final two editions of the tournament in its present format, FIFA will revamp it to include 24 teams. And that's a whole bunch of controversy, too, about a lot of the teams from Europe being opposed to that. So FIFA will have to cross that bridge later. But in terms of the coverage of the Club World Cup, that'll be on Fox Sports and Telemundo Deportes. And the December 2019 one will feature Liverpool among the teams.
IMG has announced its appointment as the exclusive global licensing representative for the Bundesliga. This follows a similar agreement they have with Serie A, which is how Serie A, by the way, got to ESPN Plus, if you're wondering.
Yeah, that's good news for the Bundesliga in terms of having a broker effectively go ahead and try to sell the Bundesliga rights. So we know that, of course, we're getting ready for the 2019-2020 season. That will be the final season under the current rights deal, most of which is owned by Fox Sports globally, most, not all. In the United States, of course, Fox Sports has the rights for one more season. And then who does it go to? We had in last week's podcast, we went into a lot of detail in terms of the options out there for both the La Liga and the Bundesliga. So definitely listen to that previous episode if you want to get our thoughts on that. last but not least, in terms of some news too, I think we mentioned a little bit about this, I think last week or the week before, but some additional news. So Univision Deportes has the rights to the Gold Cup this summer in Spanish language, and they've confirmed that all 31 Gold Cup matches are going to air live across Univision, Unimas, and Univision Deportes Network. So they're coming out really strong. Univision and Unimas are both free to air television stations, and Univision Deportes Network on most cable and satellite networks. So a big statement there from Univision, and if you do want to watch the Gold Cup, I mean, Univision is going to have a lot more coverage on over-the-air channels than Fox Sports for that tournament. Now, moving on to TV ratings, and we teased this in the opening of the show, but some big numbers that came out. Interesting numbers this week, Kartik, from some of the games, but we have to look at the UEFA Champions League final first and foremost. Collectively, across TNT, Univision, and Univision Deportes, 2.9 million viewers. For TNT specifically, that was the most watched UEFA Champions League final on cable television in the United States ever. The Univision number was disappointing to some extent. I mean, 1.4 million is definitely good, but I'm sure if it was Barcelona against Ajax, that number might have been double the size. And but overall, Liverpool Spurs, 2.9 million there. And then we had the Europa League final on TNT, Chelsea against Arsenal. That was on that Wednesday, 3 to 5 Eastern time. So that one on TNT had 413,000 viewers, so pretty decent. And last but not least, last Saturday's game between Portland in the opening of the reopening of their stadium against the LAFC. This was on ESPN2 on Saturday night from 10:30 Eastern to 12:30 a.m. Eastern. That one had 189,000 viewers there. All right, Kartik, so coming up right now, we've got an interview with Caitlin Murray, who you had a chance to speak with this week about her new book, which is called The National Team, The Inside Story of the Women Who Changed Soccer. So give us a quick take on what we can expect to listen to in this interview before we go on to the listener mailbag.
We're going to talk a lot about how the U.S. women were pioneers, the obstacles they overcame. There's a lot of that in this book, as well as the TV aspects around watching the Women's World Cup of 99. And 1999 is such a pinnacle moment in the evolution of the sport in this country. I think in the men's game as well. I think the U.S. women winning that World Cup with these record audiences on ABC really pushed soccer into the 21st century in a way that maybe was unimaginable even 3 or 4 years earlier, even when the U.S. hosted the Men's World Cup, because there was very little staying power from that in terms of general interest in the sport. But there was a sustainable interest after the 99 World Cup. So we'll talk about that. We'll talk about the struggles that the U.S. women overcame with equality issues that still faced with equality issues. It's a fascinating book, highly recommended, and there's a review from Robert Hay on our website of the book. And here's my interview with Caitlin. So Caitlin, we've reviewed your book at World Soccer Talk. Robert Hay has an excellent review of your book, so our listeners should check that out first and foremost. But what was the most interesting lesson you learned from this book?
You know, it's very in the news right now, the talk of equal pay and the players fighting with the federation. And I guess I didn't realize that that had been going on for so long, and that was something that behind the scenes had been such a part of the team's history. When I started working on this book, I didn't really necessarily have preconceived notions of what the book was going to be. I wanted to make sure I did a bunch of interviews, a lot of original reporting, spoke to, you know, players, coaches, people, U.S. soccer. And what I discovered is that really all of this, the stuff that we're hearing about now, equal pay, fighting with the federation, that has been going on for essentially as long as the team has existed. And there are a lot of things behind the scenes with the players boycotting or getting close to boycotting or not being willing to play in the NWSL and, you know, boycotting the league and, you know, Mia Hamm and Julie Foudy sitting in a conference room and telling off the president of U.S. Soccer, all those sorts of things. I didn't really know that history. And I did a lot of research of, you know, digging through old news clips and finding what the coverage was like at the time. And a lot of the stuff just happened behind the scenes without anyone really knowing about it. You know, Kate Margraf, when she got pregnant, she was kicked off the team. And it was a big back and forth about pregnancy discrimination. And it was a big issue that now we know that when players get pregnant, there's a clause in the CBA that ensures they'll have a chance to win their spot back. I knew that. I didn't know that it came from this sort of back and forth with the Federation. And it involved a player having to stand up and fight for herself. So I think that was the thing that I really took away from this. I mean, the book is obviously definitely about soccer, and I talk about all the tournaments and what went on, you know, in the locker rooms. But for me, it was the stuff in the boardrooms that I found just really fascinating and didn't know that much about going into it.
You talk a lot about the previous controversies involving the women's team and having to fight for any sense of equality. I mean, they're still not there, obviously, but and we still have issues of matches on turf, a disproportionate number of matches on turf, which the women have to play, among other issues. But the disputes in the 80s and 90s and then leading into the mid-2000s, which I think most of our listeners probably remember that particular dispute when the Federation wanted the women to go dark, essentially, for a period of time in terms of friendlies, etc., in between tournaments. The big question I have about, you know, some of your research and your conversations were, a lot of the women feel like they had this heavy burden, that this was a cause that extended beyond them. It wasn't just about them. It wasn't just about their U.S. women's national team, but it was about equality in general in this sport, which is a long way off from equality, and in society in general.
Absolutely, 100%. I think if the players had gone into some of these situations thinking that it was about them, that they wouldn't have achieved any of the things that they achieved. Because what we saw over the years, and what I talk about a lot in my book, was that the players banded together, and they only achieved these, you know, these steps forward, this progress, by working together and sort of seeing it as bigger than any one player, any one team. It was really about the sport as a whole. Something I talk about in my book is that U.S. Soccer, when there was a dispute going on, U.S. Soccer said, okay, we're just going to send a youth team to this. There was some sort of tournament in Australia, and the players were in a fight with U.S. Soccer, so the Federation said, all right, we're going to send the U-20 team to this tournament. And the players realized that if that's what U.S. Soccer is going to do, if they're just going to send youth players, we will never have any leverage. So they started the sort of like phone tree type situation where senior players were calling all the players on the youth teams. I think at the time it was, I want to say there was a U-20 team and then like a U-16 team. I don't remember the exact structure, but they essentially, the senior players called all of the youth teams, had players and their parents on a big conference call, and talked them through why everyone needs to decline a call-up for U.S. Soccer. And the youth players, they could have pushed back on it and said, this is a big opportunity for me. I'm going to play for the senior national team. I'm going to get to go overseas and play in a tournament. But instead, there was absolutely no pushback. All the youth players were on board. They saw the bigger vision of what the team was fighting for. And that was the only reason that the players essentially won that dispute with U.S. Soccer. And we've seen the players unite in similar ways since then. And that actually turned into the blueprint for the USA women's hockey team. They did the exact same thing because they went to Julie Foudy and Mia Hamm and those players and asked them, hey, how did you guys deal with U.S. Soccer? How did you get what you did? And they kind of copied that blueprint. So for the players, it was always about the team as a whole. Mia Hamm was the biggest star of the team, but she always wanted to make sure the rest of the team was included in any sort of, you know, benefits that she was getting. So that's really been sort of a defining characteristic of the team, and I think we still see that today.
Yeah, the sense of unity, I think, that the U.S. women have had, you know, with a couple of exceptions. I mean, I think the 2007 World Cup stands out as the exception.
Anything with Hope Solo.
Right. I was trying to say that a little more subtly, but yes, I, with the exception of those sort of things, has been awe-inspiring, I think, for people around the game, around the sport, and, you know, in society in general. 1999, such an important moment, and it's often forgotten the U.S. had won the World Cup in 1991, the first ever Women's World Cup. But 1999, so much changed in terms of the perception of women's soccer, or the perception of soccer in general in this country. I think it really helped the men also, quite frankly, winning that World Cup. Also made this sport really kind of a TV property. The 1999 World Cup, and you talk a lot about it in your book, those audiences on ABC broke records and then created a context where I think soccer became a real television sport in this country.
Yeah, I think something that's interesting about that, I didn't really get into it that much in my book because, I mean, the history of the team is huge and you only have so much time and space to talk about the things that are important. You can't get into everything. But ESPN and ABC, I think, needed to be convinced a little bit in 1999 to air all the games. They were obviously going to air the final. But there, it wasn't as if ESPN said, oh yeah, let's definitely air all these women's soccer games. I mean, there was a back and forth, and there was definitely a discussion to make sure that that happened from the organizing committee. But I think part of it is that in 1996, for the Olympics, when the U.S. won, those games weren't aired live on TV. I think from the gold medal match, it was just a highlights package that NBC aired. And that tournament at the Olympics did get really good attendance. And I think that the TV networks maybe saw that there was a missed opportunity, that, you know, with the attendance that it got, clearly there was some sort of interest level. So I do think that obviously 99 really changed things because that set a TV rating that lasted until the 2014 Men's World Cup for soccer. So I think that obviously was a turning point. But interestingly, I think, you know, after Mia Hamm retired, ratings and attendance really sort of took a nosedive until the 2011 Women's World Cup, which again was a really big tournament for the team and a really big deal. It was the most tweeted about sporting event at the time, I believe. So it hasn't been, you know, a straight line upward in terms of the TV ratings and the attention that the team has gotten, but it's definitely clear that 99 really sort of changed the way networks looked at, you know, having women's soccer on their air.
So 2011, that World Cup, as you mentioned, it was on ESPN, did really good ratings. And Abby Wambach's goal against Brazil, I think, was one of the most replayed highlights in history at that point, in terms of in that social media era. 2015, we know, broke all kinds of records. What are your thoughts about sustainability? Because what we see is there are these bumps in 11, 15, there'll be a bump again now in 19, and sustaining that for our domestic league. WPS collapses after 2011, right? And there were other internal issues. 2015 gave a little bit of a knock-on effect in the NWSL, but not tremendously in terms of TV numbers, although quite honestly, the lifetime numbers at times weren't that bad. It just wasn't consistent. And then now 2019, what sort of thing do you think needs to happen for there to be a knock-on effect in the domestic league? Is it really about just the personalities and the individuals, or is there more to it?
Honestly, I think that it's sort of a given that every time there's a World Cup, the attention and the excitement is going to increase, and there is going to be at least some crossover of people who watch the World Cup who are going to tune into the domestic league and see what it's all about. That's a given. I don't think there's really anything that changes that. I think what determines whether or not that bump is enough or if that bump is successful is really the league itself and how it can position itself to capitalize on that. Because, you know, you talked about WPS and their problem, I don't know if it was necessarily a lack of interest. They launched that league in the middle of the worst recession that has happened since the Great Depression. They scaled back their expectations. So I think they were more realistic about things, but they still had some problems with Dan Borislow, who I talk about in my book, who, you know, was unstable, might be a nice way to put it. So he created a lot of pressure on their finances. So I think there are specific reasons we saw WPS got into trouble. I think with the NWSL, the problems that they have, and if there is a failure to capitalize on this World Cup, I don't think it's going to be because, you know, the bump wasn't enough or the attention wasn't enough. Although, you know, if the U.S. got knocked out early, then maybe that's the case. But assuming that the U.S. goes pretty far, I think what's really concerning about the NWSL right now is that their front office seems to consist of one person, and that's Amanda Duffy, the president. They don't have an infrastructure built within the front office that is capable of, you know, talking to sponsors and signing sponsorship deals. And, you know, I think that they will probably announce a TV deal at some point. But if they had infrastructure set up to negotiate these deals and kind of sell the league, could they get a better TV deal than they're going to get? I think those are sort of open questions. One thing I report in my book is that U.S. Soccer, which is the league operator for the NWSL, their agreement to run the league expires at the end of this year. And in the past, it has expired and it's been renewed. I'm not sure that it's going to be renewed at the end of this year. I think that U.S. Soccer doesn't want to be running a sports league. That's not really what the federation is set up to do. And I think that the owners in the NWSL would like to be a little more free from U.S. Soccer in terms of like some scheduling issues and some other things. So with that sort of in limbo, I don't know if the league can really be set up for, you know, capitalizing on something like the World Cup. I think the NWSL has some other things that they need to figure out first. So I understand what you're saying about, you know, it doesn't seem like that bump has been enough in the past. I would say it's not really about the bump. It's more about what position is the league in at that time. Is the league in a position to really take advantage?
So for those of us from South Florida, it's a must read. Well, your book's a must read anyway, Caitlin. But those of us who lived through the Magic Dan era, as we call it, and went to those games faithfully, which includes, I think, both Chris and I, it's a must read. Confirms a lot of our suspicions about.
I could have written a whole, like some of the stories were just so bonkers that, you know, this book is about much more than Dan Borislow, so I couldn't include everything, but I tried to include the best bits, and it's just, it's fascinating to hear some of the stuff that went on.
So, Caitlin, where can folks find your book?
So the book, The National Team, The Inside Story of the Women Who Changed Soccer, it is on Amazon. It's also actually in Barnes & Noble, most locations around the country. If people want to see other links, I mean, you know, it's on iTunes and all those sorts of things. All the links are at uswntbook.com.
Okay, that's uswntbook.com. Caitlin, thank you so much, and enjoy your month in France.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
All right, Kartik, thanks for that interview there. Good stuff. All right, next up is listener mailbag, and first up is Vincent Orozco. He says, I have a question for you guys about the coverage and the commentary in the build-up to the U.S. Women's World Cup run. They are emphasizing this is the deepest World Cup, which I tend to agree with, and there is no mention of U.S. soccer's failure, in my opinion, to stay ahead of the upcoming countries. Question for you guys, if China would have won the 1999 Women's World Cup, would that have done more for women's soccer globally? If they're a developing, if they're a developing country, what would, what have won? In my opinion, it would have, I think, helped more undeveloped countries accelerate women's soccer because most undeveloped countries would feel they have a chance, therefore spend more resources. That's an interesting opinion there, Kartik. I never thought about that, but what's your take on that?
That's a really interesting opinion. I'm not sure, Vincent, but what I would say is that as someone who's been frustrated by seeing how poor and how uncompetitive India has been at the men's level in this sport since the 1940s, and in fact, I think this tournament they had in Qatar, the Asian Cup, was probably their best tournament that they've ever had at the men's level, major tournament. They didn't even get out of the group. But still, they were competitive, right? They didn't get embarrassed. I've often said, you know what? The Indian Football Federation should just spend their money on women's football because it's a smaller pool. It's much easier to compete at that level. In fact, India's ranking in the women's game is in the 50s. In the men's, it's never been above 100. So I do subscribe to that to a certain extent. I think it's a much easier path. We've seen Canada as a country that is a first world country, but a developing football nation, if you will, take that path and be very relevant at the women's level. That's a great observation. If China had won that World Cup instead of the United States, who knows? Other people would have taken advantage of it. That having been said, I think as far as the U.S. is concerned, I think the 99 World Cup, I think there's a lot of commercial reasons why the 94 World Cup, Men's World Cup being held in the U.S. was more important, but there were a lot of soccer fandom reasons that the 99 World Cup win by the women, to me, was more important than the U.S. hosting the 94 Men's World Cup. It was also the dramatic nature of how they beat China, and part of it was China being the opponent. If it had been Norway in the final instead, or it had been Sweden, I don't think it quite would have stimulated the passion it did, just because of ideological divides and national rivalries, etc. That's a great question, Vincent. That's one of the great historic what's ifs, because we see countries like Thailand, developing countries, do better in the women's game than they do in the men's game also. So that's yeah. A really good question, actually.
Well, for the U.S., definitely it's been transformative, that 1999 win. So many girls these days play in soccer at the youth levels and through college levels, etc. And it's something that if the U.S. had not won that 99 World Cup final, it would have set the country back. I think we are where we are today a lot because of that win, which is kind of the building block, and then going from there and you know, winning more World Cup finals. But it's something that was, for the United States, transformative. The most, the highest number of viewing numbers for soccer games in the United States is still the last Women's World Cup. I mean, in terms of the, there's what, 23, 24, 25 million for the final. Just that massive numbers there, too. So it's, for us, I know for the U.S., it definitely helped us greatly. For China, even if they had won, I mean, yes, it would have given other countries hope, but I'm not sure if it would have taken, if China would have been able to take it off, take off from there. The women's game would have taken off from there as much as it has done in the United States. And I'm sure it's had a global effect too. Happily Egg says, do you think the critical mass for soccer in the States will ever reach the stage where the advertising would allow for more free-to-air games? That's a great question too, Happily Eggs. So, I mean, you look at the UEFA Champions League final. So you look at soccer in general in the United States. Kartik and I, probably a year ago, had this big debate about whether soccer was growing in the U.S. or not. And if you look at some of the TV ratings, sometimes they're depressing. If you look at some of the ratings for, say, MLS games or the decline in U.S. men's national team games. But you look at, if you take all of them combined into one big number, there is a massive critical mass for soccer in the States. It's just very fractured in terms of all the choices available. But will it ever reach a stage where from an advertising point of view to allow more free-to-air games? And I think I mean, we've seen from TNT that it didn't. We were hoping that maybe that would have been on a TBS or, I mean, kind of a bigger channel from the Turner side of things. I think in many ways, ESPN, there's a possibility, there's a hope there that in the future, if they do acquire some massive rights, such as La Liga, is that they would put some of those games, El Clasico, if they did acquire the rights, on an ABC, which is free to air, which would be massive advertising opportunities there to a Hispanic audience and an Anglo audience in the United States. So, I don't know. What do you think on this one, Kartik? Do you have any thoughts?
Well, I think compared to other countries, we're doing okay. We had 32 Premier League games this past season free to air on NBC. We had 3 Bundesliga matches, which is, you know, in some years we've had as many as 5 or 6. But 3 Bundesliga matches this season free to air, including Dortmund, the 5-0 Bayern beating Dortmund. But that was built up over a number of weeks as a match that was going to be on Big Fox. We've had a number of MLS games. So I think we've got about 40 matches from club football overall on free to air. And then most of the Women's World Cup will be free to air.
That's true.
In terms of English language. So I think we're doing okay. There's the difference, I think, is just talking to friends in the UK, they relish the fact that the FA Cup is free to air. Here, it's not only not free to air, it's not on a cable channel, it's behind a paywall. Yeah. The flip side is the Premier League, they have no games free to air there. We have, I just mentioned, 32 games. That's almost one a week free to air. And it's not on the equivalent of Channel 4 in the UK or Channel 5. It's on the equivalent of being on BBC One, really, when you're on NBC. So it's an interesting thing. I think maybe we're valuing different things and putting different things free to air. I'd like to see more matches in general on free to air television. I'm disappointed that there are fewer games on ABC. ESPN used to put a lot of games on ABC. I don't know that they've had a game on ABC at all since the Euro final. In 2016, I think it's been almost 3 years now since there's been any soccer broadcast on ABC. Yeah. Maybe the next Euro 2020, they'll probably show the final on there, but that might be it. So, yeah, I think there could be improvement, but we're doing okay in some regards.
Part of it, though, too, is the way that the U.S. is structured. So cable television is more prevalent. So, for example, most of my relatives in the U.K., in Wales and England, most of them don't have Sky Sports. They don't have satellite television. They don't have cable television. They have free-to-air television, so they don't get to watch a lot of the soccer games because they're on Sky Sports. But if a World Cup final is on BBC, I mean, it's free-to-air. It's more accessible there for them. And if they want to watch a game, sometimes they'll just go to the ground. They'll go to Old Trafford or they'll go wherever it may be to watch a match there. In the U.S., it's different. I mean, cable is so prevalent. Yes, those numbers are declining, but and then satellite is somewhat prevalent here in the United States. So some of it is cultural differences or technological differences between different countries. But going back to what you said, Kartik, too, that's a good point. For the big tournaments, and we've got more free-to-air games for Women's World Cup than ever before, and then also for the Gold Cup than ever before, and probably Copa America than ever before through Telemundo. So
I forgot about the Gold Cup.
Yeah. So for those big events, it's happening. It's just on those club games and club finals where it's more challenging.
And I should point out, American television being different is a big. Big is an important thing. Several years ago, the NBA made a concerted decision that they wanted more games. They wanted to take some games off of broadcast television, free to air television, and put them on cable because they were going to get subscriber fees. You know, the residuals from subscriber fees for that. So there's some of that going on too. Now I think that's changed with the advent of cord cutting, and maybe the NBA's rethunk that decision. I don't follow the NBA, so I don't know what the breakdown is in terms of what's on network television, what's on cable anymore. But at one time, the NBA very clearly and identifiably said that we had too many games on broadcast television, free-to-air television. We're going to pull some of those games away from the rights holders and give it to Turner, our cable rights holder. So that's something that you have to consider when you think about American television in general.
All right, last question and or feedback from one of our listeners, and this one could be a whole podcast in itself. So Kartik, if you want to answer this one in a concise manner, but it's from Raymond. He says, "Do you think the future of American soccer is going to look like a traditional American pyramid, like they have in Major League Baseball, with 30-32 team division and conference playoffs, hundreds of minor league affiliate teams scattered throughout the United States and Canada, as well as having a spending policy like Major League Baseball, with top teams being able to spend what they want as long as they pay a luxury tax to the bottom team?"
Yeah, I think Ray actually asked this question when I was on the Geber show talking about a similar subject. But I think he asked the question and we didn't get to answering it. So thank you for asking again on this medium. I think we're kind of going in that direction. However, USL seems reluctant to allow any more affiliate or not affiliate teams. They'll allow affiliate teams where an MLS team is loading five guys or whatever, five young players to an existing USL independent team. The USL, my understanding is getting a little more reluctant to allow reserve teams and two teams, which is a shame because I think if you have a closed system, which we have, that's the best way to develop players. Now, I would advocate opening the system and having promotion and relegation and incentivizing smaller teams to develop players and scout locally. And if you have between UPSL, NPSL, and all the USL leagues, we have about 400 or maybe 250 to 300 potential teams to be in a pyramid that could scout locally and help develop players that way. But if you don't have that, I guess this minor league affiliate thing might be a good might be the only other option. I would advocate going the pro rel route, but if you're going to have close leagues, I think it's better than what we got. In terms of the luxury tax, this is something I like. I backed off of the idea of salary caps. I used to think salary caps were good for competitive balance, but now I realize they're also bad they curtail the ambition. The more ambitious clubs, they don't allow the kind of natural spending and development of a transfer market that you would need. So as long as you have a salary cap, you're going to have a limited transfer market, which is kind of the currency that fuels this sport globally. A luxury tax is a good idea. In fact, the NASL implemented a luxury tax toward the end of its run, didn't really get much fanfare for it because the league was collapsing for other reasons at the same time. But I think that's the solution. And in that league in particular, you had two teams, the Cosmos and Miami FC, that were spending a lot of money on players, but they were being taxed or being fined, if you will, or taxed for that spending. That's better than having a hard salary cap, in my opinion. And I think a luxury tax isn't a bad idea for a league like the Premier League. Now, I think the TV money makes it maybe not as necessary in the Premier League. But let's say a league like Serie A, where Juventus is spending disproportionate to the rest of the league, or SPL is the best example, right? Celtic spending disproportionate to the rest of that league, that maybe they need a luxury tax there, which allows the other 11 teams in the Scottish top flight to compete, or at least recoup some of the benefits of Celtic spending.
Interesting. Very interesting. Okay, well, listeners, if you do have any questions for us about TV rights, streaming, watching your soccer on TV apps, whatever it may be, or other questions, you can always reach us via email through web@worldsoccertalk.com, as well as facebook.com/worldsoccertalk, and on Twitter @worldsoccertalk. Plus, of course, you can also always post your comments on the mothership, which is worldsoccertalk.com. And don't forget, too, the World Soccer Talk podcast is now available on the Pandora mobile app. And thank you for listening. You can get a new episode of the World Soccer Talk podcast every Thursday. Every episode is released on SoundCloud, Spotify, Pandora, YouTube, Stitcher, iTunes, TuneIn, Audio Boom, and worldsoccertalk.com. If you like the show, share it with your friends on social media and give us a review on iTunes. We'd greatly appreciate it. And Kartik, heading into the Women's World Cup, as well as I think Major League Soccer still is playing some games, and I'm sure there's other games happening from around the world too, as well as, of course, UEFA Nations League final. This is going to be Sunday, I believe. What should they do?
Enjoy your football.